We're holding on page 60 in Yuma, about the middle of the page, Tanya Rabbis Yomer, middle of Osamche. We're in the middle of learning all about the Mon, which we got into that by way of talking that Pasuk mentions affliction in connection with the Mon, and that ties in with the Ta'anuas Nafshisecham of Yom Kippur, and therefore the Gemara is digressing at some length to talk about the Mon and all of its qualities. The last thing we learned was that actually the Mon had the ability to tell about a baby who the father was. If we had a suffix, whether a baby, a woman we married within 3 months of her husband's passing or their divorce, and you're not sure, in later times, in fact, you have the halacha that a woman has to wait 3 months after that before she remarries precisely for that reason. But Tosfos Yishronim points out, at this point in history, they hadn't made that zera yet, precisely because the mon would clarify things. Depending where the portion of mon for the baby fell, they could tell easily enough who it belongs to. There is an interesting point, by the way, that Achronim talk about as far as that, and as far as the next piece that we're going to talk about over here, about how the Mon would clarify different other questions in Halacha when you had an argument between two people. They ask, how on earth can you decide Halachas based on such things anyway? What happened to Torah Lagashamayimi? And there's a couple of different answers, among them that here they didn't use it so much in order to decide the halacha, but rather in order to induce people to tell the truth, as we're going to have the next example now, where two people are arguing over the ownership of a slave or something like that. The point is, once you have that the mon falls in a certain place, then that would make the person realize, you know what, I'm not going to get away with it. I may as well fess up and tell the truth. So there was that. With that said, though, there are a couple of achronim that discuss the point that maybe we know you can't use Ruach HaKodesh to decide the halacha. However, you can use it maybe to establish what the metzius is. The Chidah actually talks about this in Hilchos Tefillin. You have a concept. Yeah, in Hilchos Tefillin, we know you can only write Tefillin on the skin of a kosher creature, a kosher animal or bird. The Gemara discusses the question: would you be allowed to use the skin of a kosher fish? Now, it is mutter b'ficha, so therefore on that grounds it should be mutter. However, you have the point. The Gemara says that the skin of a fish has a bad odor. It has a very fishy odor to it. The question is, is that odor strong enough after you turn it into parchment to still be a problem? And the Gemara mentions the concept of Yahweh Eliyahu. If Eliyahu will come, he can tell us one way or the other whether the zuhama, whether the smell that's in it, is enough to cause a problem. Page 60 in Yoma, about the middle of the page. So the question is, the Chidah says, what do you mean if Eliyahu comes? It's a matter of halacha, isn't it? And he says, no, this is a matter of metzius. To have Eliyahu tell us what the metzius is, that we can do. That's not total Eb Shemayim. To tell us what the halacha would be, that you can't. Now there you also have different achronim talk about there. I think Sam Sofer talks about, for example, there's a difference when we talk about, sometimes we find in the Gemara that Eliyahu comes as a neshama in a guf. That's different. Then after all, he was a Talmud Chacham in his time. So of course he has the right to tell us his opinion in halacha, just like any other Chacham. But on the other hand, sometimes he comes only as a neshama. So then we have to say turtle of a shemayim he, but on the other hand, again, we can say that he's able to tell us a metzius. So by the same token over here, to use the mon or to use Moshe's Ruach HaKodesh or other possibilities like that they could do because it's not telling us a halacha, it's rather telling us what the actual facts on the ground are. And then the result is the halacha will be this way or that way. Anyway, so the Gemara continues. Tanya, Rabbi Yosi, Keshem Shah Novi, how you magid lahem the Yisrael, Mashab Chodim, or Mashab Sadokim, just like a Novi can tell the Jewish people what's in holes and crevices, Achamon, magid lahem the Yisrael, Mashab Chodim, or Mashab Sadokim, the same way the Mon had the same property, it would also be able to inform people of what's in hidden places, things that people would never know the facts, otherwise the Mon would clarify for them. Ketzad, what's an example? Shnayim shebolof nei Moshe l'din. For example, two people come in front of Moshe for a din Torah. Ze'oma abdi gamnavta v'ze'oma ata mechartali. Reuven says to Shimon, you stole my Evan. Shimon counterclaims and says, I bought, you sold him to me. So, omalahem Moshe, so they come to Moshe for a din Torah. Omalahem Moshe, dinu la boker mishpa. We'll judge the case in the morning. Meaning, in other words, exactly that. We'll wait until the mon falls. Now, the Mephoshim point out, Moshe didn't really have to do that. He could answer them on the spot with Ruach HaKodesh. But again, one of the points is that he wanted to wait till the morning. One point is, based on what happens with the mon, the guilty party himself will confess that he's not telling the truth because he'll realize he's been exposed by the mon. So lamacher im nimtza oimer beveis rabbi rishon. The next morning, if they find an extra oimer in the household of his original master, be a durash is engunver. Then you know that the other guy stole him. Nimtza oimer beveis rabbi sheni, and if you find it in the house of the other, if you find it in the house of the second master, be a durash is a macher loy. Then you know that he sold it to him. So then, Marsha points out also when we learned before that the mon is called kezera gad lavon. It's called it's shaped like white coriander seed. One meaning of lavon over here is that clarifies and whitens what the din is, because then everybody sees what the actual facts are. And in this connection also, they mention it in the Chassam Sofer mentions an interesting point in this connection about Moshe using his Ruach HaKodesh. The Gemara tells us in Bava Kamma, we had it in Daf HaYomi about a week ago, that where do we learn the concept of HaMotzi Mechavel of Araya? The Gemara first tries to learn it from a pasuk that Moshe says to the Jewish people before he goes up to Har Sinai for 40 days to receive the Torah. He tells them, Mi Bal Dvorim Yigash Aleihem. Anybody who has a Din Torah should go to Aaron and Hur, because I'm going to be away for the next 40 days. And from there we learn Yigash Aleihem, that he should present his arguments to them. Then the Gemara says, you don't need that because there's a Svara. Anyway, so why is this, so Chassam Sofer points out, why is this principle being taught only now when Moshe is going up onto Har Sinai? And that's the point, because Moshe himself didn't need that. When two people come in front of him for a Din Torah, he can paskin using his Ruach HaKodesh. He doesn't need Edim and all that. In fact, by the way, technically, even in later times, a couple of the Mephoshim discuss over here the point, even in later times, there is actually a point in Halacha, a Dayan is not always required to have Edim in order to paskin Halacha. The Rambam describes in Hilchos Sanhedrin that, for example, a Dayan can rely on his gut feeling or on something that, for the Gemara gives an example in Ksubas, where Rava's wife tells him about a certain woman that she's not trustworthy, and Rava knows not to trust her with a Shavua, therefore. But a Dayan can use extra legal means like that to find out certain facts that he can use in his judgment. Now, the Rambam says in later times, it was agreed that Bate Dinim can't do that anymore, because not all Bate Dinim are so are of such caliber that we can rely on them to do that. But of course, Moshe Rabbeinu is based in is, so he could use that. So therefore, only when he's going up to Har Sinai, and Aaron and Hur, even though they're Nevi'im, they're not of the caliber to be able to do that kind of thing. Therefore, he has to introduce to them the concept of Amotzi Mechavel of Araya, and things like that. This, by the way, this whole discussion also gets into the very interesting question that poskim of this generation, last one, deal with, for example, as far as DNA testing and different other kinds of modern scientific methods that you can use to determine someone's identity and to determine the fatherhood of a child and so on and so forth. To what extent can we use them in halacha? Based on what we're saying so far, it sounds like there might be a certain amount of room for them. On the other hand, a number of poskim point out various problems with it. Among them, that after all, in halacha, you do have, for example, in halacha, you have, as far as the paternity of a child, you have a concept called roiv be'ilus etzel abal. Regardless, even if we have reason to know that a woman was mizana, nevertheless, we assume that any children from a married woman are from her husband. Lahavdil, they have similar concepts in goyish law as well. So therefore, not necessarily, even if we find the DNA test to the contrary, is not necessarily going to change that. But they do, for example, post-Machroinim have used it, for example, as far as identifying people who were killed, for example, September 11th and other examples like that. They've used it for those kinds of things. So to that extent, we do have that there can be things beyond the regular rules of evidence and halacha that can be used. Anyway, continues the Gemara. V'chein ish v'isha shebol lefnei Moshe l'din. Similarly, you have a married couple comes in front of Moshe to a Din Torah. Hu oimer hi sorcha alai. He says that she's acting badly towards me, therefore I should be able to divorce her and she should forfeit her ksuba. V'hi emeres hu sorcha alai. And she's saying he's acting badly to me. I'm perfectly entitled to my ksuba. So again, Omalahem Moshe, Dinu Labokum Mishpat. So Moshe again would tell them, we'll judge, we'll give the verdict in the morning. The next morning, if they find her Omer of Mon in her husband's house, then you know that she's the one who was doing wrong. And if you find it in her father's house, then you know that he was the one who was treating her badly. Nusach Acher, and then you have an opposite Nusach. This is the this version that we had over here is the way it's printed in the Gemara. So that in Yaakov brings an opposite Girsa in Nimtza Oimur Beis Bailav Yadusha Sarah Haleah. The other way around, if it's in her husband's house, then you know that he's the one doing wrong. The Nimtza Beis Abiyah Yadusha Sarah Haleah. And if it's in her father's house, then it means that she was doing wrong. So what's the deal? How do we understand these two? How do we understand these two Girsas? So Hakosef points out over here, on the face of it, the girsa that he has here in parenthesis, the Nusach Acher, on the face of it is the more correct girsa. If it's found with Vase Baila, the Adorshu is Sarah Haleha, meaning, in other words, that he's the one acting wrongly to her, but that doesn't necessarily mean the fact is he still needs to consent to give her her a gift. Until that, they're considered married. Therefore, he's obligated to support her. Therefore, it belongs in her husband's house. Mashenkin, if he's so chalav, she's the one acting wrongly. For example, she was mizaneh, and therefore he needs to divorce her. Then it goes in her father's house, because then, in other words, that's where she's going to remain thereafter. So therefore, he prefers that girsa. But he says, on the other hand, you consider Rashi is mentioning the factor of the ksuba. That makes things the other way around. Now that makes it more likely to say the other way around, that if she's if he was mistreating her, then we would say that, in other words, so he has to, if he's going to divorce her, he has to pay her huksuba. So it's not just that he can really nearly divorce her, he still has to pay her huksuba. Therefore, there's more reason to say that it would be that he's acting wrongly, and therefore the Omer is going to stay by her father's house until he shapes up. So Marsha similarly explains that, like this, if she acts badly, but he wants to stay married to her, look, then she's still his wife, therefore her Oma belongs in her father's house. But if he's acting badly, then since he can divorce her anytime he wants, then therefore her Oma should belong in her father's house. So therefore Marsha explains more according to the Girsa that we have in the Gemara rather than Nusach Acher. And different other Mephoshim talk about different angles on it. Ben Yehoyada points out there may actually be a difference. Maybe you could reconcile both two. So it depends what the argument between them is. Is the argument that she's saying he's mistreating me, he's beating me, or whatever, he's not acting as a Jewish husband should towards his wife? Or is the argument between them that he's claiming that she was mizaneh, in which case they would be obligated, if that turns out to be true, then they'd be obligated to get divorced. So that may make the difference of whether the Omer is where the Omer is going to be found, respectively, depending whose argument has more validity. More about the man. Steve Uvereda Satala Machna Loyola Vagomer. The Pasuk says that when the dew would fall on the camp of the Jewish people by night, then the man would land on it. So that implies that the man fell right there inside the camp. Then you have another pasuk that says, though, when the mon is first introduced, Hashem tells Moshe the people should go out and gather it, implying that they have to go outside the machna. And then in Baha'al Oscha, when they're complaining about the mon, it says the people had to spread out. Shotu means they had to like stroll, they had to take a long hike to find the mon. So what is it? Where did the mon fall exactly? So, okay, tzaddikim yod lehem al pesach batehem. For tzaddikim, it would land right in front of their door. Beinanim yotza ambalachdu. The medium people that would have to go out, but not too far. Rishoyim shatu ambalachdu. And the Rishoyim would have to go all the way out, way far outside the machna, in order to gather. Marsha points out, after all, the context of the pasuk Shatua Am is where the people are complaining about the mon in Parshas Baal Oysa. Therefore, that makes it that fits with what the Gemara is saying over here, that this is referring to the Rishoyim who are complaining about the mon. So therefore, Hashem made it for them that in a way, I guess you could say they have reason to complain. Sort of their mon as it is found very far away, but the vort is, you know, they'd have the choice to shape up, and then their mon would fall closer to them, and instead they didn't, and instead they complained. Like we talked about last week, there was the idea that the mon was a constant barometer of where a person is standing beruchnius, and not everybody was comfortable with that, with having it shown to them and in front of everybody where they're standing, and that was part of the reason for the complaint itself. Similarly, the Gemara says, "Ksiv lechem uchtiv ugos uchtiv v'tochenu." One pasuk describes it as that it fell as bread, which implies that it's ready to eat. Another one implies ugos, which means that it has yet to be baked. An uga, Rashi says, is mashma kodim afia, implies that it hasn't been baked yet. An uga is like you have, for example, ugos matzos and other such expressions in various psukim, where we see an uga is a loaf of bread baked directly on the coals. So almost like a, you could think of almost like a, like the dough of a pizza that's baked directly, or like a matzah that's baked directly on the floor of the oven. So, so uga implies that it's not baked yet. It's almost ready, but you still have to bake it. And then nuchtiv v'tochnu, then again, b'haloscha, it describes that they have to grind it up, implying that it needs a lot of preparation. So what is it? Hoketzad, same thing. Tzadikim lechem, the tzadikim would receive it as bread, ready to eat. Beninim ugos, the beninim would receive it as ugos, where it's almost ready, but not quite. Rishoyim, tochnu b'rechayim, and the rishoyim would actually have to grind it up. Marashah points out that when you get down to it, even for the tzaddikim, we don't necessarily mean that it actually fell in the form of bread. After all, the pasuk describes it fell dach mechuspas. So it was this fine, flaky. It was this flaky like substance. So rather, what it means is for the tzaddikim, it was ready to eat like bread. For the Beninim, it wasn't quite ready to eat yet, and therefore they'd have to bake it. And for the Rishoyim, they'd even have to grind it. Again, since the Pasuk V'tochnu is talking about in Parshas Baaloscha, where they're complaining about the man, therefore it fits that this is the Rishoyim we're talking about. Marashah also points out that actually the Rashi on Chumash learns differently than our Gemara. Rashi on Chumash mentions when the Pasuk describes how they would grind it, and they would bake it or cook it, and it tasted, as the Gemara is going to quote that part of the Pasuk soon. Rashi explains over there, it doesn't mean that anybody had to grind it or bake it or anything like that, or cook it or anything like that. It means the mon could taste like any ground or cooked or baked food. That obviously, Marashah says, obviously that differs from our Gemara over here, which is saying that there were people who literally had to go and grind it. Okay. Next, the pasuk says oy dochu b'medoicha, or so we said they would grind it with millstones, tochnu b'rechaim, oy dochu b'medoicha, or they would pound it in a mortar. Now, a mortar is not the kind of thing that you use for pounding grain to make into bread. So what are they doing with a mortar when it comes to the mud? This teaches us that together with the man, there fell for the Jewish people women's cosmetics. Dovish and nidich memeducha, that's the kind of thing that you pound in a mortar. That's not the kind of thing you grind with millstones. When you have the herbs and spices that women are going to use for cosmetics and perfumes, then you make them in small quantities and you pound them in a mortar, similar to the way they made the ktoras, for example. So the point is, not only they had had food, but also Hashem gave them also this, that they had cosmetics for the women. Ben Yehoyada says it doesn't actually necessarily mean that literally it had cosmetics. It means that the mon itself made people look so healthy and beautiful, the women didn't need cosmetics. In other words, it's as if the cosmetics are included in the food, and therefore they don't need anything else. Then the pasuk continues with Vishlu Baporu. Then it says they cooked it in a pot. So again, we're talking about that the mon was mainly bread, then you don't cook bread in a pot. This teaches us that along with the mon, also there fell for the Jewish people seasonings for stews. So in other words, so they had the mon, which could taste like anything they wanted, and in addition, together with the mon, there actually fell seasonings that you could use to make a nice savory stew. So that's a rishlu baporu. That would be the kind of thing that you cook in a pot. Whether it means, for example, that they'd shecht some of their animals and use these to season them, whether it means the mon itself would taste like seasoning like that, whether it means they would use it when they were seasoning the slav, whatever the case, the point is that we're learning from this word of Vishwa Bapar. Again, Rashi on Chumash says differently, that it just means that the mon could taste like anything that's cooked in a pot. But here the Gemara is saying there's two separate things. The mon itself was their staple food, their bread, and then in addition they have the tzike kdera, the seasonings for a stew. Then Yehoyada, by the way, connects this Alpi Kabbalah. The Gemara mentions in Pesachim that one reason why do we say Baruch Shem Kored Machos Elan Vod quietly when we say Krishna. The Gemara mentions over there a mashal involving that's like Tzikek Deira, it's like a princess that smells this delicious stew and she wants some, but it would be embarrassing for her to admit it publicly. So her maids start bring it to her in private. And the same way, like we say, we want this praise of the Malachim so much, but like we have to say it in private. See, connected up the Kabbalah that we're saying over here, there fell for them to see Kedera. It means this kind of thing, but they had a heightened experience of El Akus, the kind where we're able to have a minute bit of it. When we say Baruch Shem, they were able to have it on a much higher level. A pasuk says, in connection with the donations for the Mishkan, the pasuk says, "V'heim heviu elav oid nedava baburka baburka." This is also going to tie in with something about the month. It says they brought Moshe more nedavas for the Mishkan every morning. Now, my baburka baburka. So, what does it mean? They brought it every morning. In Parshat Pshat, it means exactly that. They brought it, and Rashi mentions on the pasuk, means that in 2 days they had all the materials for the Mishkan already. But the question is, why mention Davka Baburka? And what, they were only bringing in the morning, they didn't bring the rest of the day? So Amar of Shmuel Banachmeni, Amar of Yenison, Mon Hayerd Lahem Yisrael Baburka Baburka, Herded Lahem, together with the Mon that fell down, Baburka Baburka, where also it says the word Baburka by the Mon, so together with it, Herded Lahem, Hashem brought down for them, or different, the Girsa in printed Gemara, Midaber, Midaber, Shayyard Lahem, Baburka Baburka, they used for the Mishkan something that fell down every morning, Malamit Shahem Yod Lahem Yisrael. This teaches us that there fell for the Jewish people, Avonim Tovus Magolius Imam Mon. Together with the Mon, there fell precious stones and pearls, and those are needed for the Mishkan, because they need them for the Choshen and for the Ephod. Interestingly, we learned previously when we were talking, also a few blocks ago about the tzitz. Tosfos mentioned a point over there that maybe the tzitz actually had pearls on it as well. Or actually Marsha had mentioned that point that we talked about the relative, we talked about the crown of Torah versus the crown of Kahuna and so forth. And Marsha said over there that maybe the tzitz was actually decorated with pearls as well. In that case, they would have needed pearls for that too. Whatever the case, those fell with the mon, and that's when we say that they brought baburka baburka, therefore the pasuk is hinting to us that they brought something that fell down together with the mon in the mornings. Shenemar, as in fact it says in the pasuk, v'anesiim heviu es avnei ashoyam. The nesiim brought the shoyam stones and the other precious stones that they needed for the ephod and the choshen, v'tonen nesiim mamsh. We learn in a blaise that nesiim over there means the actual, means literally, so we usually understand it means the nesiim of the shvatim. And Yav Rashi mentions over there that they delayed in bringing other things because they figured we'll fill in whatever was missing. And then in the end, everybody brought, and therefore the only thing they have left to bring is the Avnei Shoyim and Avnei Miluyim. But here the Gemara is understanding that it means it wasn't the human Nesiyim at all. It was Nesiyim means clouds. Shevachenu Omer, as you find a pasuk, Nesiyim Baruach V'Geshem Ayin, you have a pasuk that mentions there are clouds and there's wind and there's no rain. The context of the pasuk continues, Ismis Halal, Ishmis Halal, the Makas Shoker. We have a person who prides himself on a false gift. The Gemara elsewhere in Nintinus explains that it means you have somebody who makes a big public pledge for tzedakah and then doesn't come through with it. Then because of that, Hashem holds back the rain. So in a similar vein, we see the word Nesiyim means clouds. So therefore, it means that the clouds from which the mon fell, also precious stones and pearls fell with them. And that's what they brought for the Mishkan. So now Marsha is bothered, but first of all, Marsha explains the reason is because if it means the actual Nesiyim, then we'd have the question, well, why didn't they bring it at the beginning? Now you have what Rashi explains on the pasuk that they figured that we'll fill in whatever's missing, but still, the Gemara doesn't want to understand it that way. The Gemara is assuming if the Nesiyim are actually going to bring something, they would have brought something right at the beginning. So therefore, the Gemara is understanding that it means the clouds. Now Marsha does wonder though in that case, why are we mentioning that Gemara assuming that Nesiyim? Now there are various other psukim that use the word Nesiyim for clouds and Tillim, for example, Yamala Nesiyim, Ktzei Aretz. So why is the Gemara dafka picking this pasuk? So the Rif over here brings in some detail that the vote is that because we're saying the Nesiyim, because they didn't bring anything, therefore Hashem prevented them from bringing anything at all. Even the precious stones and pearls, Hashem didn't have them bring. Hashem supplied them with the mon. So they end up bringing nothing for the Nedava of the Mishkan. Therefore, this pasuk Nesiyim Baruach the Geshem Ayin is very appropriate. Like they said, we're going to bring because we'll wait until everybody else brings and then we'll bring. And in the end, Hashem made it that they don't bring anything at all. We do find they made up for it by the Chanukas HaMishkan where they brought the wagons and the oxen and all the korbanos that we have in Parshas Nasa. But therefore, that's why the Gemara Dafka brings that pasuk to illustrate how badly they had acted, which we know in the pasuk. That's why there's a yud missing in the word vanasim over there to hint at their flawed conduct. There is actually an explanation that says that it's both. The mon, with the mon came down precious stones and pearls, and then the Nesi'im took those and they supplied them for the Mishkan. So in that case, it would be both. Both the Nesi'im as in clouds and Nesi'im as in the human Nesi'im. Okay. Getting back to the mon, the pasuk says, V'hoya tamay ketam l'shad ha'shomim. The taste of the mon was like the taste of l'shad ha'shomim. Now, Rashi on the pasuk explains that the word l'shad in the simple sense, now the Gemara is going to doubt it in a couple of ways over here, Rashi explains in the simple sense, l'shad ha'shomen means an oil-soaked, means a cake or a wafer soaked through with oil, which and honey, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, so it tasted very delicious, and it was very delicious and very filling and very nutritious. But here the Gemara is going to doubt it, Amar Rav Abahu, I'll take you l'shad el shed. Don't read the word l'shad, which would be understood either as Rashi says that it means some kind of cake or wafer, or that it could mean shad, a breast of when a mother nurses her baby, which the Gemara is going to bring that drasha in a minute. But first, Rav Abahu is saying that we actually read the word as if it said a shed. Ma shed zem is hapach l'kam agvonim, just like a shed transforms into many different forms. A shed can appear in many different forms, depending on what Hashem needs him to do. Gvanim literally means colors, but it means, in other words, in this case, it means like a shed can appear in different forms. The Bach, or the Hagoris Bach, and the Gemara brings over here that you find in a Medrash, for example, by Lahat Acherav HaMisapechas, that turning sword that guards the way to Gan Eden, the Medrash mentions in that connection that Hashem put Shadim over there to guard it, and sometimes those Shadim appear as men, and sometimes as women, and sometimes as different other forms, so that's what the Gemara is calling over here as Kamagvani. Marshal refers also over here to this Gemara in Sanhedrin that mentions a type of shadim called Sore Shem, literally means the masters of oil. And the point is that the oil, you see many different colors in it. The light reflects often in different colors, so therefore that can also indicate that these shadim will come in many different colors and many different appearances, and that would be what it means over here. So Afa Mon, this happens for Kama Taimim, the same way the Mon can turn into many different flavors. Ikadami shad mamish. Others say that the word l'shad means exactly what it sounds like. Shad, meaning a woman's breast. Ma shad zek calls man shad tinik mamashmish mamoitz makamatayim. Every time the baby grabs for the breast, he tastes different tastes in it, because whatever the mother eats comes out in her milk. Afamon calls man shi shol ochonoise moitz makamatayim. The same way every time the Jewish people would eat the mon, they would taste different flavors in it. Now, Rashi on the pasuk points out that, and Marshall refers to it over here, that Rashi is bothered by the point, if it meant l'shad, and it meant a breast, what would that have to do with shomen, which means oil? And Rashi says over there, if you're going to say that shomen is maloshen shomen, fat, then Rashi points out the nekudas of the word don't really fit with it. It would have to be hashomen, with the accent on the mem and with a tsere under it. Instead, hashomen is maloshen shemen, just at the end of the pasuk, so the first segel changes into a comment. But here, the Gemara is doubting as just that it means a fat breast, and it means, in other words, that the baby always tastes a different taste in it in the same way it was with the mon. They say, by the way, a cute vote on this, given that in the midbar, everybody had whatever they needed in terms of food and clothing, whatever. So how was anybody able to do the mitzvah of tzedakah in the midbar? So I don't remember where this vote comes from, but somebody says the vote. Imagine you have somebody who knows the taste of a very good food, and then you have his neighbor never got to eat that kind of food. So he has no idea even what it should taste like. So the rich person would do tzedakah by telling him what you should have in mind next time you eat the mon, that it should taste like such and such. And that way he'd be doing a mechesed, that he'd be able to taste that taste. Okay. Onward. When the mon is first introduced, the pasuk says, "Vayomer Moshe, v'seis Hashem lochem ba'erev boso lachol." Hashem is going to give you meat in the evening to eat, meaning the slav, the lechem ba'boker v'svaya, and Hashem is going to give you bread, meaning the mon, in the morning, that you're going to be satisfied. So why that difference? Why not have the slav in the morning as well? And why is it describing the slav as only lechol and the mon is l'svaya? The difference is they asked for bread properly because bread is the basic staple that a person needs to live off of. So therefore, so it was reasonable of them to ask for it. Therefore, Hashem gave it to them at a proper time in the morning where they're going to be able to have time to prepare it. The main meal will be later in the day. If it falls first thing in the morning and they collect it then, they'll have plenty of time to prepare it. But meat, which they asked for improperly because they had lots of animals, they could have shafted their mikne rab. They had the tzonu boka mikne covered ma'od. It says when they left Mitzrayim, so everybody had lots of animals. They could have shafted some if they really have a craving for meat. So therefore, so they asked for it improperly. Nitin lahem shaloi kahogen. Therefore, Hashem gave it to them improperly, meaning that it comes in the evening and they don't really have the time. They don't really have the time to prepare it. Marsha says, the fact is that the Gemara is going to establish that the Gemara is going to say right now that a person's main meal with meat should be in the evening. So what's the problem having the slav fall in the evening? They'll eat it in the evening. So okay, so you could say because they don't have enough time to prepare it. However, Marsha says, based the way that our Gemara is phrasing it, it seems to come out that what the Gemara is actually focusing not so much on the difference between morning and evening, but the fact that the bread is described as lisboya, they're going to be able to be satisfied by it, they're going to have a generous amount of it, whereas the slav, Hashem is saying only lechol, you're only going to have to eat. So in other words, not enough to, you're not going to have that much of it, just Hashem is going to give you some to show that he can do it. And the Gemara continues, Mikan limda Torah derech eretz. Here the Torah is teaching you proper behavior. Shalo yechol adam baser el ba'erev. A person should eat meat only in the evening. Because we see Hashem provided the slav in such a way that they're only going to eat it in the evening. So again, according to Rashi, it comes out that these two things are connected. Like this, the proper time to eat meat is in the evening, but because Hashem is giving it to them, shalo kahogen, it falls in the evening. They don't really have enough time to prepare it for that evening's meal. So like Hashem is sort of giving it to them grudgingly because they didn't really need it in the first place because they had plenty of animals. According to Marashah, these are two unrelated statements. First, we're saying Hashem gave them only a small amount of slav, just enough they have to eat to show that Hashem has the power to do that. But then as a separate thing, since we see that the slav fell in the evening, we see that that's the proper time to eat. My pastor says, ask her again, a person can't live without water. I mean, even by the mon, we find they complained. They asked in a complaining way, and that's held against them. But still, the fact is that at least they did receive the mon. Yeah, the pastor says they received the mayim generously as well. That was later on, because Hashem told him to hit the rock, to speak to the rock, and he hit it. That's something else. But yeah. What? They're within their rights to ask, yeah. And after all, the first time Hashem did tell him to hit the rock. So yeah. So the Gemara says, what do you mean you should only eat meat in the evening? Abaya had said earlier in the sugya, since we said that in what way was the mon an affliction that the pasuk calls it vayancha vayarivecha vayachilcha samon, or the man on aistecha, the pasuk says Hashem gave you the mon in order to afflict you. So at the beginning of the sugya, we said that Abaya said where one point was because they couldn't see the actual shape of the food in the mon. It still looked like mon. It would taste like anything they wanted, but they didn't have the satisfaction of seeing the actual food in front of them. And Abaya had derived from that. Abaya, high man de islay sudasa, a person who has a suda to eat, loy nechle elabiyamama. He should eat it only by day, because then that way he'll be able to see it. So what are you telling me here, that a person has a suda of meat, he should eat it at night? And the answer is ka'enyamama kamin. We don't mean it literally has to be by day. It means that it should be like the day, in the sense that there was light. So fine, if a person should eat his suda with meat at night, but he should have illumination over there so that he can see what he's eating and he has the maximum enjoyment from it. And as we learned previously, the Ion Yaakov brings from a medrash, that is precisely the reason why we have Shabbos candles, is just that our Friday night suda should be with the maximum possible enjoyment.
What about the fact that eating meat at night like that is not so healthy and could lead to carry because it's late at night and all that? Better not eat it so late at night.
Well, that depends. I mean, if a man is married, then there's not, and his wife is Tahar, then there's not a problem with carry, right? Okay, so then men who aren't married and men whose wife aren't Tahar, okay, so maybe they shouldn't eat such a soda by night. Right, Right, okay. I mean, the Gemara is saying a general rule over here. Obviously, every rule is going to have exceptions. I mean, a lot of the health advice that the Gemara brings, the Rambam says differently in Hilchos Deis, and then later nutritionists and whatever say yet different. So, yeah, to a certain extent, it depends on circumstances. Yes. Well, no, that's true. Also saying that's also true. We're not saying late at night. Yeah, we're talking about first thing in the evening. We're talking 6 or 7 p.m. or something. You're not going to bed until a few hours later. Yeah. Somebody
surely you're.
Interesting. Okay. So another thing. Okay, so speaking of nutritional plans and meal times, so the Gemara continues. Amar Rav Acha b'Yakov, Amar Rav Chista, b'tchilo ha-Yisrael, doyvim l'tana gerlim shem anachlin ba'ashba. Originally, the Jewish people were like chickens pecking around in the garbage, meaning they'd just be eating a little here, a little there, like snacking throughout the day. I mean, you have to imagine, you know, they've been for a long time in Mitzrayim as slaves. It's not a bad time to sit down and eat a proper meal, so they were just grabbing food wherever they could. Until now, Moshe came and established for them a proper time for Suda. He tells them that the mon will fall in the morning and the slav in the evening, and those are going to be your main meal times from now on. You're going to have a defined time for breakfast and a defined time for dinner, rather than just snacking throughout the day like they've been doing before that. Maushar points out, like this, the Gemara mentions in elsewhere that the fourth hour of the day is Zman Suda L'chol Adam, fourth hour of the day, let's say between 9 and 10 in the morning, if the sun rises at 6 and sets at 6, then that's the normal time when most people eat, and that fits with the mon. The mon you could collect until the end of the fourth hour, and if they didn't collect it by then it would melt away. So therefore, that fits with the. So Moshe was telling them, collect it by the end of Zman Suda, otherwise it's going to melt away and you won't have it. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Gola, Yudimel Tavis, comes to Tchias HaNesim. We have the how is the goof going to be rebuilt? So we know the famous idea. There's the Etzem Luz that's always there. Some say it's in the spinal cord. Some say it's at the base of the skull where you put the knot of your Tefillin Shorosh. Some say it's at the base of the spine. Whatever. At the time of Tchias HaNesim, Hashem is going to soften that bone with the tal shel tchiyah, with the dew of tchiyas hamesim, and then it'll turn into se'ur la'isa. It'll be like sourdough that you use as a starter for a new batch of dough, and the whole body will be rebuilt from that. This is what Rebbe explains in a letter. Now, why dafka? What's the source of etzem luz that it lasts forever? So one reason is because that bone doesn't need any kind of nourishment. Therefore, it didn't get involved in the chetei tadas. So therefore, it never participated in that. And then in that catastrophe that brought Misa to the world, therefore it's unique in the body that it never goes through Misa, and therefore that it's going to be used to rebuild the whole body. There's also an idea that there's different places where it talks about. One place it talks about that it has anah from kiddush wine. I think it also talks about, and from Malav Malka. Yeah, but at least that it didn't have anah from the Chatei Tadas at any rate. Yeah. Okay, we were continuing. We were talking about halachas of mistakes in davening on Shabbos. So before we talk about if a person accidentally starts the weekday brachas during one of the Shabbos tefillahs, what happens if a person does the wrong middle bracha for Shabbos? For example, it's by night where he's supposed to say Ata Kiddushta, and he starts saying Yismach Moshe or Ata Echad or whatever. So if you remember, before he gets to Hashem's name in the bracha, or as the Alter Rebbe phrases it, before he finishes that bracha, then he should start over and say the proper bracha. If he only remembers after Hashem's name, then he just says Mekadosh HaShabbos, and he's Yotze B'dieved, because the main part of each one is the part that we say Lekeinu V'Kavisenu, Ritzeinu V'Nochasenu, and after all, we say that equally by every one of the tefillahs. Now again, that only applies to Maariv, Shachris, and Mincha. Musaf is different, because by Musaf, you have to mention the Korbanos Musaf. So therefore, so here when he didn't mention it, so therefore he'd have to start all over regardless. Similarly, if Davin Musaf instead of one of the other tefillahs, you have the same problem in reverse. He's mentioning the Musaf in a tefillah where it doesn't belong. And that amounts to saying a sheker in front of the Eibishter, and you can't. One more halacha in that connection. When it comes to Yom Tov tefillahs, if you have, you're supposed to finish Mekadosh Yisroel Vazmanim, and he finishes off Mekadosh HaShabbos, then if he remembers Mekadosh Kedei Dibur, and he says Mekadosh Yisroel Vazmanim, he's Yotze. If not, then he has to start all over again from after the Chartanim. There was actually not so a while back, there was a whole chart that Rabbi Bruin had put together that showed all these different details of all the different possible permutations and the mistakes that a person might make in Shabbos or in Yom Tov Davening, when you have to go back, when you can continue as you were, etc. It was hanging up on the shul wall here for a while. I don't know where it disappeared to, but I'm sure you can find it online, or if not, then I imagine the basement probably still has copies.
Yeah,